Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, we're taking the 10 freeway to China. Some of the best Chinese food in the country is right here in Southern California. I'll introduce you to a man with no sense of smell, a look at the ban on shark fins and what it means for ocean life. Plus, Jonathan Gold's here with a restaurant for us to try. But first, Laura Avery's at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with a look at what's fresh and in season this last day of April.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Everybody who comes to the market is looking for good and healthy locally grown food, but a lot of us have a sweet tooth. And Charlie Schaefer is here from Schaefer's Genuine Foods, and he uses our wonderful California-grown pistachios in a really unique recipe. And Charlie, can you share that with us?
Oh, I'd love to. Look, there's a lot of great things you can do with pistachios, but one of the things we really like to do is to make a roca, which is like a hard candy. It's like the best teeth bar you've ever had. So what you do is you take sugar and butter and water and you just cook it till it gets to hard crack stage. So it really starts to get caramely, starts to really get those dense bubbles. Then once it gets to be a certain temperature, I think it's about 280, you take the raw pistachios and put them in, and just they kind of toast right there in the hot caramel. Stir them in, give them a couple of minutes to toast, and then pour them out onto a sill pad and let it cool. And then once it's cooled off, it's really hard. And so you want to take some chocolate, some white chocolate, some dark chocolate, and just melt that and then pour it right over the top. Let that cool down, and then you can crack it and eat it right up.
Oh, my gosh. And you serve that as a dessert at Schaefer's?
We do. We also use it to garnish different desserts. Oh. And we also just like to put it on a dessert table as one of several things that people can just kind of snack on. It's also great for gifts.
Absolutely. So just random chunks of this stuff sort of broken up, put in a bag. How about just pulverizing it and sticking it on ice cream or something like that, too?
That's a great idea, Laura.
That sounds so good. And now when you're using they're called the pistachio kernels, mm-hmm. which are just the raw out of the shell nuts sure. that you buy by the bag over there. Saves you tons and tons of time. And you can just dump them in whole. They're small enough, you can just put them in there whole.
No need to chop them.
Okay, great. And Santa Barbara Pistachio is a wonderful local grower. They actually have recently become certified organic. They're good about keeping their nuts very fresh, releasing them in small batches so you never get stale old pistachios from this stand. They're super.
One of the highlights of coming to the market is there's always someone from their stand out there in the middle of the street trying to pass them out and you always have to take them up on it.
That's right. I mean, how can you say no? Do you want a pistachio? I don't think anybody's ever said no to that.
I've never seen that.
All right, Charlie, so tell us where Schaefer's Genuine Foods is.
We're in Venice, and we're a catering company. We do catering and events.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Another seasonal favorite that comes to the market just about Easter time every year is the wonderful Tangelo, which is a citrus fruit. We're talking with Leticia Garcia from Fallbrook down in San Diego County, and they have a wonderful citrus farm and organic citrus, and you're bringing in Tangelo. So, Leti, explain to us what a Tangelo is, and it has a unique appearance because it's got that nice bump on top.
A Tangelo is a cross of a pomelo and a tangerine, and it's very juicy, hardly any seeds. It does have that big nipple that separates it from like either a grapefruit or a mandarin.
Right, and Tangelos, the reason I like them is they're very intense, but they're not too sour. They just have this really intense, concentrated citrus flavor, really rich. It's just a unique experience. So now would you say they're pretty much at their peak?
Yeah, you usually always wait till they're right at their peak. We don't want to bring them too sour because then we could just wait. We're not going to lose them. They're not fragile. They don't have fragile skin. They'll hang on the tree. Okay. So we have to bring them right when they're sweet.
And do they normally start right around Easter time?
They're a little bit late this year. They should have been out maybe about 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. So why is that?
Everything is late this year. We've had our bloods were late, starting from our satsumas. Our satsumas were almost a month late, and everything kind of just pushed out.
We can probably trace all that back to that really rainy December we had, huh?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, people don't realize that here we are, it's Easter time, you know, it's time to get the certain fruit we expect, and like, why isn't it here? Oh, that rain from December 4 months ago, right?
Exactly.
That's how that works. And how long will the Tangelos be around?
I want to say at least 8 weeks.
Oh, just 8 weeks? Uh-huh. Oh, for citrus fruit. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, and they make wonderful juice.
Very juicy. And yes, wonderful for juicing. It doesn't separate like a navel. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, okay. And your farm is completely organic. And tell us what markets we can find you at.
at the Wednesday and Saturday at the Promenade, and Sundays at Main Street and Ocean Park in Santa Monica.
Okay. All right, Leticia. Well, thank you so much. And these Tangelos really are tasty today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Leticia Garcia. Her family farm is called Garcia Organic Farm, and they come up from Fallbrook in San Diego County. They have a wide selection of all kinds of citrus fruit and avocados as well. Be sure to join us at the Santa Monica Main Library on Thursday, May 5th from 7 till 9 p.m. We're having our second library panel of the year. And this panel is entitled Preserving the Bounty. We're going to be having an expert panel of canning and preserving experts talking about how to make vegetable and fruit preserves from the wonderful produce we have at the farmers market. It will be moderated by Akasha Richmond of Akasha Restaurant. Panelists will include master preserver and canner Kevin West. We'll have Valerie from Valerie Confections and farmer Barbara Spencer from Windrose Farm, all talking about how to can and preserve the delicious flavors of the season. Hope you can join us there. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Charlie Schaefer's roca is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Boy, is it delicious, I have to say.
I've got a sweet tooth, licorice drops and jelly rolls. Hey, sugar daddy, I'm so need some sugar in his bowl. I'll lay out fine china on the linen and polish up the chrome. If you've got some sugar for me, sugar daddy, bring it home. Blackstrap molasses, you're my orange blossom, honey bear.
One mention of the words shark fin in a good food segment pretty much guarantees that we get a slew of mail. Usually the words are heard in conjunction with the word soup. Shark fin soup, of course, is that popular Chinese dish that's usually served at festive banquets. It adds a very unique texture to the dish. The increasing demand by a growing Chinese middle class for the soup has created a real crisis for shark populations. John McCosker joins us here on Good Food. He's a senior scientist and the first chair of aquatic research at the California Academy of Science. John, could you paint us a picture of the situation, just how overfished are shark at the moment?
As you know, many species of fish in the world's oceans are severely overfished, and some have disappeared from the market. None are as yet extinct. However, amongst those overfished species, sharks are probably in the worst condition. As many as 90% of the sharks in the world's ocean have disappeared. Many species are locally extinct.
Now, let's talk about the greater ecological damage that the toll on the sharks takes generally. What happens in the ocean to the food chain in general when you take out that predator?
Well, when one takes out the top-level predator, as most adult sharks are in those ecosystems, one removes that level of the food chain that is controlling all of the levels beneath them. And the food chain is like a pyramid, so that one shark might eat 10 seals, that might eat thousands of fish, that might eat many, many thousands of smaller fish. You remove that top-level predator and you allow the next level of the food chain to increase dramatically. There's no control over it. And therefore, they end up eating so many more of the next level, and the whole system, like a house of cards, collapses. Sometimes other predators enter the food chain and replace the sharks that were present at that level, but they don't do it very well. And we have found, for example, in America, that if the sharks are removed from Chesapeake Bay, cow-nosed rays, a very large stingray, replaces the sharks, yet they don't eat the things that the sharks ate. Instead, they ate all the scallops. So now the scallops are removed, changing the ecology of the Chesapeake Bay and putting a lot of scallop fishermen out of business. What one wants in any ecosystem is a level of top-level predator that keeps the system in balance.
Now, describe the current shark fishing practices.
For the most part, sharks are very easy to catch. As you know, many shark species eat anything in front of them, and a fisherman need only have a string of hooks on a line and put the line out overnight, and every hook would have a shark on it. That is 10, 20, 30 years ago. Nowadays, fishermen don't catch that many sharks because so many areas are so severely overfished. When the fish are caught, they're brought to the side of the boat, and the fins are cut off, and then the shark is left in the water or dumped back into the water, where it undergoes a death spiral to the bottom of the sea, bleeding as it goes down, and there it's either consumed or just rots on the bottom of the sea. You see that the shark flesh itself, although edible in most cases, is expensive to refrigerate and of little or no value as compared to the fins themselves. So a fishing boat can catch thousands and thousands of shark fins and let them dry. They don't require refrigeration. And so the sharks are just left to die in the ocean, which is a waste of oceanic life and also resulting in terrible ecological damage.
Is there a history of shark fishing before the fins became so popular?
Sharks have been fished for many years, primarily for the oil within their liver, and that provided a source of vitamin A, and that went on until the synthesis of vitamin A made it possible that you wouldn't have to catch a shark at all. Sharks were caught and so severely overfished to remove their livers that they nearly disappeared from San Francisco Bay, or at least some species. So they were made, shark fishing was made illegal for a long period of time. Sharks are just very vulnerable to overfishing because, as you can imagine, a cod, which has small eggs, can lay millions of eggs in its lifetime. Whereas a shark, which is very slow growing, very slow to reach sexual maturity, and sharks either give live birth of as many as 20 or 30 young, or lay very large eggs. Some sharks only have two or three young every couple of years. You start killing them, as now goes on, and killing them such that they can't even reach sexual maturity. It makes them very, very vulnerable to local extinction.
But now, is there no regulation, or are there loopholes that allow this predation to happen?
Well, it is interesting that America became aware of this problem and made landings of sharks on the Atlantic and Pacific coast illegal if the fins weren't attached. So therefore, a shark fisherman that just wanted to cut the fins off and throw the carcass away had to change their strategy, and they then brought many fewer large sharks back to the market. And a loophole existed that allowed the importation of shark fins separate from the shark bodies if they came from foreign countries. So here in California, one of the largest consumers of shark fins, and for the purpose of shark fin soup, has used this loophole and brought in thousands and thousands of shark fins that were imported from China or from Mexico. And now California is trying to close that loophole, as Washington and Oregon will soon do, and Hawaii already have done.
Now, I understand that you think that the future of the ocean is nothing but jellyfish.
Well, that's pretty much hyperbole when I said that, but I mean that when I say that, because that's what the oceans have become in much of the world. At one time, the Mediterranean was a very, very rich sea. And now, when you look at the Mediterranean, you see very, very few fish. The fish have been imported to the Mediterranean for sale. But what one does see when you're underwater in the Mediterranean is jellyfish, more and more and more jellyfish, because their predators are no longer there, and they are consuming the food that fish would have eaten. Many parts of the world now have an extreme overabundance of jellyfish. It's the default position of so many of these food chains. And that's because we have so fouled up ecosystems in the food webs.
John McCosker is a senior scientist and the first chair of aquatic research at the California Academy of Sciences. The California legislature recently introduced a bill banning the sale of shark fins across the state, and it's getting resistance from some members of the Chinese community. I've got links to several articles about the issue at kcrw.com/goodfood, and I'd love to hear what you think. Leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Of course, there's plenty of really incredible Chinese food available that does not include shark's fin soup. Coming up after this short break, we'll find out where to get the best Chinese food in L.A. Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. If your idea of eating at a Chinese restaurant is to order the egg roll, then either you never listen to the show or you haven't yet picked up the newest issue of Los Angeles Magazine. Leslie Barger-Suter's the dining editor of the magazine. The new issue is an in-your-face seduction of why we need to get in our cars and drive to China. Our local China, that is. So our local China, Leslie, the San Gabriel Valley.
It's our backyard. It is our Chinese backyard. I knew the bit about this, but really until we got in there nitty-gritty, I didn't realize that the San Gabriel Valley is better than our Chinatown, which we sort of know. But pretty much any official Chinatown in the country and possibly North America, the San Gabriel Valley is it. It has the largest array, and the key is really the most authentic array. They've got regional specialties. This isn't all Cantonese food. It's not all broccoli beef. You know, there's Muslim Chinese food, and there's, you know, different kinds of noodles, and there's stuff from the North and the South and weird regional specialties that haven't yet been sort of Americanized and adulterated yet. So they're really authentic.
Because all of these restaurants are serving one of the largest expat Chinese populations in the world.
Absolutely. But because of that, when the general American public, I'll go ahead and admit this, me, wants to go out there, it can be a little intimidating because, to be honest, this isn't a market that's catering to you. But if you really want to experience the best in Chinese food, there's no reason you shouldn't go out there. But yes, it can be a bit daunting.
How do we go about sort of taming this beast in our mind?
Well, this was a big sort of personal undertaking for me. I was fortunate enough to work with a great author and a local Chinese food expert named Carl Chu, who for him, this is every day. So for him, this was no big deal. For me, you know, I'd been out there several times to eat and experience, but never really tried to get by. And it can be intimidating from a language standpoint. You know, most of these places really don't speak English. So how do you, if you don't have Carl Chu on your arm, like I was fortunate enough to, how do you figure this out? You can actually go online ahead of time and maybe get a sense of what kinds of foods you're interested in trying, what kinds of restaurants have them. You know, Yelp is a great resource for this. People write about this stuff all the time. Jonathan Gold has written about this stuff all the time. We've written about a bunch of this stuff at Los Angeles Magazine. So get a sense of where you want to go. But I mean, don't be afraid to take notes and write these names down and show them. Write them on a piece of paper and show them to the servers.
Now, is the San Gabriel Valley a lot like the San Fernando Valley where there's, like, is there a Ventura Boulevard where there's just a strip where block after block after block, everything is pretty much concentrated in that one area?
We have Valley Boulevard in the San Gabriel Valley. It spans several cities, and it's the same street that goes all the way through. And to only further confound things, the addresses on Valley Boulevard change every city you cross into. So let's say you're looking for a certain number of Valley Boulevard. You could find that same number 6 or 7 times. So you really need to map these things first before you're going to go to find them. But yes, on Valley Boulevard in that single street, we wrote about this place that's a Omar Halal restaurant that basically does Muslim Chinese cuisine. It's Uyghur cuisine is what it's called. They do a lot of pilaf that you kind of eat with your hands. They use a lot of sort of more more spices and seasoning that you associate with sort of Central Asia than you do Chinese. But there's also, there's Happy Kitchen. There's a place called Liang's Kitchen that does this sort of pan-Chinese fusion cuisine that came out of the military barracks of Chiang Kai-shek's army, and sort of how all these people kind of came together, ended up in Taiwan. What the heck did they do? So they pooled all of their sort of culinary know-how from all their different regions, but using Taiwanese ingredients, and came up with this weird sort of sect they kind of call barracks cuisine that's evolved.
Now, you put, of course, together a top 10.
We sure did,
as usual.
We are Los Angeles Magazine. What would it be without a list of some sort?
So take us through some of the top 10 that you sort of experienced yourself or you heard enough talked about that you you feel like you could talk about.
Sure,
it.
Yeah. Well, Patrick Q is the decider of the list, our restaurant critic, and he has kind of been researching this over the last 9 months to a year, I think. He really spent a lot of time out there doing a lot of research. He has the Kam Hong Garden, which I was just saying I loved, is on his list, that does all these great noodles, and it's really sort of a refined version of Chinese food. It's really nice. But his number one restaurant that he chose is Sea Harbor, which is one of those giant Hong Kong-style seafood houses that does sort of dim sum and things in the morning, but in the evening there's, you know, the wine lists come out and, you know, they're serving these gorgeous poached prawns, and they've got this sort of bank of fish tanks against the wall that are bubbling, and you can see the things you're about to eat. And it becomes rather refined in the evening. It's sort of this, you know, steamy, tea-soaked smorgasbord of a dim sum place in the morning. But in the afternoon, it turns really sophisticated, and it pulls off both really well.
What about for people who just love food that is searingly hot?
Spicy food is something that, of course, the Chinese know much about. They've got Sichuan. They've got Hunan. The Sichuan peppers, there you can find all over the place. We found at a Hunan restaurant a toss-fried lamb. That's probably the spiciest dish that we found. That's sort of bits of meat that are flaked with chilies, just glowing in nuclear red. And it's lamb, so the gaminess of the lamb and the heat really kind of work together. But there is nothing innocent about that dish. It is crazy, crazy spicy.
So do you have any other tips for us on how to navigate the great Valley of China?
Well, just know before you go, go to the ATM, get cash. Most of these places do not take cards. So, which I found myself doing the long, lonely walk to the 7-Eleven to hit the ATM after a couple lunches. So go and get cash. But really, you know, there are Chinese names for these things that have, you know, you can write out in English characters. If there are some dishes that sound interesting to you from this program, from the magazine, just write some of them down on a piece of paper and show them. I really think the largest issue is sort of a language barrier. And even sometimes there aren't things that are listed on the English menu. There was one place I wanted to try. I was obsessed with the idea once I heard about it, of this medicinal turtle jelly, which is turtle, apparently, is supposed to cool your qi. So it's a cooling thing. And they basically boil turtle, I'm sorry to say, and it comes out with this sort of like neutral, almost anise-flavored green bowl of gelatin, and they pour a sugar syrup over it. It's considered a dessert. But I really wanted to try it, so I was taken with my good buddy Carl Chu to this restaurant, and he starts ordering it, and I'm flipping through all the pages of the menu, and it's not there. And I can't tell you how many times I found this at these restaurants, that there is an English half of the menu, but the dishes that are listed there are not the same that are listed on the Chinese side of the menu. So, you know, if you don't speak Mandarin, you're at a bit of a disadvantage. So if you want to try the turtle jelly, write the name down and show it, because sometimes it's not even listed as an English option.
So for people who are just completely averse to going to China locally, is there anything for them?
I mean, sometimes it's not just being averse. Sometimes it's 6 o'clock on a Tuesday and you're like, I need some Sichuan peppercorns right now, and you live in, say, Culver City. So sometimes it's not that you're averse, but sometimes you just need Chinese food now. We did venture out and find over across the city, maybe not restaurants that are as good. We say it in the issue. We are sorry, Los Angeles, but the best Chinese food's in the San Gabriel Valley. You're not going to find it outside. But we did find a few places that serve some dishes that you can at least get a sense of what these flavors are like. For instance, Luxian, which is a new restaurant from Sang Yun, who's not Chinese, but he does these spicy chicken pops that he does, or these little sort of chicken drumettes that he douses in a whole ton of spices, including, you know, a pretty hefty dose of the Sichuan peppercorns ground up, so you really get that sort of mouth-numbing thing. He also does the same thing with a dish of Dan Dan noodles, which is kind of a rich, nutty noodle, which is really great. WP24, good old Wolfgang Puck, actually does the really extremely labor-intensive, time-intensive version of Peking duck that not even a lot of restaurants in the San Gabriel Valley do. A lot of them sort of cut corners and do roasting instead of drying, and there's a lot of different sort of techniques. This is the real deal. The chefs there actually learned it. They hang these ducks out, and they're not messing around.
Well, thank you so much. As always, every time we finish talking, I'm really hungry.
Me too.
Leslie Barker Suter is the dining editor for Los Angeles Magazine. I've got their list of top 10 Chinese restaurants at kcrw.com/goodfood. Share your favorites at kcrw.com/goodfood or on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Jason Pfeiffer has called himself a man without taste. He hasn't had a sense of smell for, few decades now. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how are you?
So how long has it been for you?
It's been as long as I've known myself. I'm 30. I think I lost my sense of smell when I was a kid, but I have no memory of it. So, it could have been as an infant. There are so many different things that cause sense of smell loss, and also so many different types of smell loss. There's anosmia, which is complete loss. There's hyposmia, which is, partial loss. I have a sort of severe hyposmia. I can sense just the most basic information, which really just means that if I walk into a candle store, it is different than what it smelled like before I walked into the candle store. That's about as much as I get. So it's just different. So you talk to researchers, you'll hear lots of different statistics, and nobody's really quite sure of a proper number.
Now, many of us use the words taste and flavor interchangeably, but there is a difference. Can you explain it?
Yeah, there's a big difference. It's funny because I will often say that I have no sense of taste because that's the thing that people kind of respond more to when I'm trying to explain my condition. But taste is actually a really specific thing. It's not what you think of when you experience something. So when you put something in your mouth, the first thing that you do really is, in fact, taste it. That's only getting sweet, salty, sour, or bitter. It's really just the basic information that your tongue gives you. But the odor molecules from that food go to the back of your throat and up and are read by your olfactory nerves, which is your sense of smell. And that's what creates a sense of flavor. So that's the difference between, chocolate and sweet. When I put a candy in my mouth, I can tell you that it's sweet, but not that it's butterscotch. And that's because my tongue works just fine, but it's my nose that's broken.
So when you were a kid, did other children recognize that the way you ate was different?
No, my parents did. They thought that I just didn't have a whole lot of interest in food. And I didn't, I wasn't as motivated by it. Not that I was unhealthy, but I just didn't really care. I mean, people would talk about food in this really reverential way, and we would eat, and people would do what they normally do, which is that they would give me something and be like, "Ooh, taste this. This is excellent." And I would try it, and it would be perfectly fine based on what I know about it, which, isn't that much. But it never occurred to me that I was just experiencing things in a different way than they were. That didn't come until I was in college, in fact, because that was the first time that I was with somebody who kept pressing me on it. It was a girlfriend at the time, and she had just had an amazing sense of smell. I mean, we in fact left a theater once, and she left her pocket, she left her purse, and she was able to go back into the room afterwards and find it because she was following the trail of scent of perfume from the woman who was sitting in the seats in front of us. I mean, that's way beyond, certainly my capacities. But she was the first person who said, what's in this? Try this. Is there rosemary in there? And it's like, quite frankly, I don't even know what rosemary means. So I said to her after enough of this, I don't think that I'm getting anything like what you're getting out of this. So we did a blind taste test, and I closed my eyes and tried mint ice cream and peanut butter ice cream, and I had no idea which was which.
That moment that you had, was it an aha moment? Was it emotionally devastating, or was it just intellectually explanatory?
It was not devastating in any way. It was fascinating, actually. I mean, it was, you know, it can't be devastating because I haven't had it. You know, it's the equivalent of somebody coming up and telling you, I have really bad news for you. You can't fly. You know, it's like, I already know I can't fly. You know, it takes a while to start reconsidering these understandings that you have of food and your world. So this has been a process that's sort of rolled on continuously. But one of the first ones was when I reconsidered my understanding of wine. I always thought that the wine pairing system, that this wine is great with that food and this wine is great with that food, I thought that was just total, just a complete marketing scam, because every wine is the same. How could one possibly match another food? And it wasn't until I realized that I just wasn't picking up the differences in these wines, except that, you know, red wine is warm and white wine is cold, that that perhaps there's something different. And I mean, even more recently, I was having a conversation with somebody and they described the differences between tastes in vegetables. And I said that, wait, you mean like broccoli and carrots taste differently? Because I just figured they're vegetables. Why wouldn't they taste the same?
So when you go out to eat, how do you decide what you're going to order?
Well, I think about it. I mean, part of that is because I have to order something, you know, like I can't go into a restaurant and say, give me the food, because, you know, they don't have it like that. So, I think about it. I think about texture and I think about portion size. And there are certain foods that I like more than others. There are certain types of even within the same foods, I'll give you an example, shrimp. I like small shrimp, but not really big shrimp, because big shrimp is just, I don't know, it's got this kind of gross meatiness to it, whereas small shrimp can crumble in your mouth a little easier. I mean, crumble's the wrong word, but you know what I mean. And when I don't, because I don't have the ability to take any pleasure from the food outside of just kind of the way that it feels in my mouth, some foods are not that appealing. Lobster is another one. It's just kind of rubbery and weird. I think about the textures and also I think about what I feel like eating, which actually is not any sort of craving thing. I don't have cravings. I've never experienced cravings. I say it right now, cravings, but I don't really know what that means. I've never had it.
Why is that? Is it because cravings are always connected to memory and memory is linked to smell?
Yeah, well, in a way, I mean, you know, that second part is not quite as necessary. It's because if you look at a brain scan of somebody who's having a memory and a brain scan of somebody who's having a craving, the same part of their brain lights up. It's a memory. It's a memory of food. In the same way, by the way, that when you have a song stuck in your head that you're really experiencing the same sort of thing. So I have no memory of these foods. I mean, sure, I have a memory of eating it, you know, but I don't, my brain doesn't have a memory of the taste. There's nothing to seize upon. So instead, you know, I mean, my body will, as I think, I assume everybody else's does, will feel that perhaps I need something lighter or healthier, or that I'm feeling fine and I can have something a little fattier and still enjoy it. So I'll be guided by that, but I will not really be guided by much else.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jason Pfeiffer, who has no sense of smell, which of course affects his sense of taste. He's had this condition for most of his life, and it's even proven to be hazardous.
Or it's proved that it could be hazardous. I haven't yet been harmed that I know of. This came to light most notably when I was living, in fact, with that same college girlfriend. And she was in the other room at a computer, and I was in the kitchen, and I was washing dishes and looking down at the sink. And she yelled from across the apartment, "Hey, is something burning?" And I said, "No, of course, nothing's burning." And she's like, "Are you sure? Are you sure that nothing's burning?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely, totally, nothing is burning." And she came into the kitchen, and I am standing there looking down, into the sink scrubbing dishes. And next to me, I mean, literally next to me, so much that I could have put my arm around it if I wanted to, was this George Foreman grill pouring smoke. I mean, like, and not just food smoke, like thick black. There was an electrical problem with the thing. It, like, was pouring smoke. And I didn't smell it. And it was right next to me. And that was the first time that I thought, well, geez, I don't want to die in a fire. So that's actually the first time that I was motivated to get this thing checked out. And that was years after I actually discovered that I had this problem. But, you know, it manifests itself in other ways. I live with my fiance now, and she has to smell all of the milk before I drink it, because, you know, it's like once you've had milk for a few days and you kind of forgot when you bought it, I can't just smell it to see if it's still okay. I'll ask her if a shirt smells. I rely on her to tell me if my breath smells. And so, you know, those are sort of annoyances, but the smoke thing and the gas are really do freak me out. So I make sure that I've got plenty of smoke alarms and in my apartment. And my mom, of course, really makes sure that they're all working.
Do you have any eating advice for those of us who have intact smellers?
Yeah, I do. I have plenty. although some of it is not things that I can really follow myself. One of the things that I found most interesting while I was researching this was how easily accustomed we all become to smells and tastes. And I have a really truncated understanding of that. You know, if I walk into that candle store and I smell something different than the air outside the candle store, which is, you know, again, about all I can get out of it, that difference goes away really fast. You know, I mean, it's a sensation that I have for a few seconds and then it dims and then everything is the same again. And the reason that I can tell that difference at all is because telling differences between things, just simply picking up that things are different from each other, is kind of the foundation of our olfactory abilities. It's what we're kind of programmed to be able to do. And, you know, you can only speculate on why, but the best guess would be because we developed the sense of smell and taste to basically identify whether something was safe or not. And if something was safe, then, you know, we were able to just sort of carry on. But when something was different, when a new smell came in or a different food was in what we were eating, you would want to be aware of that right away to make sure that it was safe. And, you know, now most things are safe. So that's really not a concern. But what we do experience is the initial difference more than a kind of consistent experience. So if you sit down with a sandwich, you will, as researchers tell me, because honestly, I don't know this myself, but you will taste less of it by the end. The first half of the sandwich will taste more than the second half will. And that's because you're just getting the same thing. As soon as you took a bite, your brain was like, what is this? And then it was okay. And so your brain was like, all right, carry on with your sandwich. But that's perhaps not the best way to eat. If you have smaller portions, if you keep kind of jumping around, you will be able to experience things and have them not dim down in your brain by the time you're ready to move on to the next. I suppose this is why tapas is so popular, although I hate it because it's just small amounts of food that all taste the same and maybe they look different, but who cares?
It's been so interesting talking to you. Thank you, Jason.
Oh, thank you, Evan.
You can find Jason Pfeiffer's piece in the current issue of Men's Health. Next, Jonathan Gold's here with a restaurant for us to try. The Pulitzer Prize winner is taking us to a museum. Yes, you heard me. We're eating at LACMA today. That's in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman, and I'm joined by Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly. He joins us here every week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, we're going to the new restaurant called Ray's at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, or LACMA.
There's been this big trend across the country about putting restaurants that are not so bad into cultural institutions. Probably started by the extremely good restaurant called Modern at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I suppose this is the restaurant at LACMA, part of Joachim Plechal's group.
The bar is called the Stark Bar, so that must mean there's a link to Ray Stark.
Ray Stark was a movie producer, a very well-known movie producer, who was a big donor to the art museum forever. Of course, you know, walking across an empty plaza at night, you know, especially like lit up with that, you know, gigantic, glorious Chris Burden light post sculpture. And you see Stark Bar, it makes you think of, you know, Iron Man.
But it's beautiful. I think that it's going to be just packed during the summer. That bar just invites you to sit out and drink. It's lovely.
It is. And they have jazz on Thursdays, I believe, and a lot of, you know, really pretty chairs outside, and you're sitting outside among the outdoor sculpture and the interesting architecture of the museum, and it's a good place to be.
Who's at the helm of the kitchen at Ray's?
We have seen this chef before. It's Chris Morningstar, who we have seen at Maison G, and we have seen at Blue Velvet, and we have seen at, I think, District most recently.
And I know that he's spending a lot of time sourcing produce in particular, a lot of vegetable stuff.
A lot of vegetable stuff. So, you know, this is a place where you are going to be able to get ramps during the brief season. It's a place where you're going to be able to get English peas on everything during the 3 weeks when they're most glorious. There's a really nice dish of ricotta gnocchi with English peas and pea tendrils and walnuts and shavings of pecorino that just feels like early spring. It's nice.
I noticed on the menu that you have that he's serving that elusive Italian springtime vegetable, puntarelle.
I didn't notice that until you pointed it out. I love puntarelle. It's one of my favorite things ever.
Yeah, me too. Also very brief season.
Very brief. You almost never see it here. You know, it's a chicory from which you take almost all the leaves and
Discard them.
And the stems are very sort of weird and Dr. Seuss looking. And you usually toss them with dressing with lots of anchovies in them.
What else did you have?
They had a squab that was a nice sort of roasted squab, very rare. Sort of stuffed under the skin with a dressing of, like, you know, salsify and onions and I think chopped truffles and stuff like that. A delicious dish. And I guess a striped bass with sunchokes and grapes and green garlic. You'd have to have the green garlic in there. I don't know why you'd have to have the grapes in there. It's a little early for grapes, but they were doing what they do. There was a nice dish of lamb sweetbreads that were sautéed, you know, with artichokes, pine nuts, and mint. A pretty classic Roman dish, actually.
I remember when I ate there, I wanted to go. I thought to myself, I want to come back and I want to just eat all the vegetable sides on the dish. I found his take on vegetables was really good,
which is nice at a time where so many chefs are going so far over to the carnivorous side. Not that I have anything against that, but it's nice to see somebody who's taking time to think about vegetables, too.
So is he playing with favas this time of year, then?
Yeah, there was a really nice dish of sautéed whole favas in their pods.
Ooh, I like that.
You know, they were, I guess, either sautéed or they were roasted. They were sort of blackened on the outside. You could eat the pods, which you can only for, like, again, like a week a year, and sprinkled with malt and salt. A nice dish.
The restaurant was designed by Renzo Piano,
right?
Famed architect. What did you think of the tables with the little drawers?
The tables were very interesting. I don't think I've seen many like that here. You sit down, and at every place, there's a drawer right to the left of you, and you pull it out, and your napkin's in there, and your silverware's in there, and you take it out, and you set it up, and there you are. You don't have to wait for somebody to bring it over. I was almost disappointed that between courses that the waiter didn't come and just tuck new silverware in your drawer as opposed to laying it out in front of you.
And you don't get the kind of feeling of sitting in a glass box that you think you're going to get by looking at it from the outside.
Really? I did get the feeling that I was sitting in a glass box.
Oh, you did? I didn't. I guess I felt that it disappeared as the sun went down.
Possibly. I went there fairly late at night, and it actually felt, once you were inside it, maybe slightly less like a glass box than like you were in a party tent.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that there were things going outside and people were wandering around the plaza. And like, as I said, you have a beautiful view of the Chris Burden installation. And it felt like you were someplace.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly, and we've been talking about Ray's, the new restaurant at LACMA. Coming in May, I'll be at the Stark Bar, next door to Ray's, for one of our monthly Good Food Happy Hours. Details are coming in the next couple of weeks. You can sign up for a weekly text message with the exact address of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions. Just text the words Good Food to the number 69866. That's Good Food to the number 69866. We also have a map with all of Jonathan's picks. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, some of our listeners have noticed that many of those blue dots representing Jonathan's suggestions are frequently in the San Gabriel Valley. So I asked Jonathan to explain why. Why does he review so many Asian restaurants? And why are many of his choices so far away?
When I started doing this seriously, I guess, when I was writing for the Los Angeles Times in the early 90s, I used to think that when I was in a restaurant that was the very first restaurant serving, say, real Hunan food that's ever existed in the Western United States and having dishes that were blowing my mind. And Ruth Reichel, my boss, was stuck eating at the 43rd Best Italian restaurant that had just opened up on, you know, Beverly Boulevard and having sort of a miserable meal and writing about the same menu that everybody else was serving all over town. And I was definitely getting the better end of the deal.
Which is perhaps an answer to the other question, which is why you don't concentrate on the, quote, bistro segment.
If there were amazing bistros, I'd be there. And when there are amazing bistros, I write about them. I eat out a lot in my role as talking about restaurants here and writing about restaurants for the LA Weekly. I probably go to 300 restaurants a year. I have to say that other than the handful of miracle workers at the very top of the food chain, and you know, we've talked about them all many times over the years, that the most interesting cooking in Los Angeles is not done at the sort of mid-range places, but at the restaurants doing the cooking of Southeast Asia, of Japan, of China, of, you know, Latin America, which we have such an amazing concentration of here, and we have such amazing diverse communities, and their food is often really good.
What is your, like, total comfort personal wheelhouse in terms of flavors? What is it that you really love if you're just eating for yourself?
I don't think what I like is that different from what other people like. I know that when I used to live in New York and I used to come to Los Angeles, that I would end up going on the way from the airport. I would end up at a taqueria and I would end up at usually a Vietnamese or Malaysian or Chinese restaurant on the way home, because those are the flavors that I was just unable to access. Those are the things that are available here in just tremendous form. That the Korean cooking in Los Angeles is such that Los Angeles could be thought of actually as an outpost of Seoul, you know, the farthest precinct of it. And we have a big community where Koreans are cooking for each other, and they're cooking astonishing food, and they're cooking the food that they themselves want to eat. And we've never really had a big Italian community here, at least not since the turn of the last century. We've never had a French community here, really. I mean, there's a lot of French people who live here, and there are a lot of French cooks here, and some of them are doing very good work, but there isn't the French restaurant for French people that does amazing French food that only French people are going to know about.
It's the whole thing about the immigrant community that arrives first and then the different levels of restaurants that end up opening to serve them.
Exactly. And with Chinese food, for example, there's this big continuum from the really old places that are often third generation, fourth generation, fifth generation restaurants. Then there's the thing of restaurants after that from people who arrived here after the Immigration Act of 1965 made it possible for people who weren't necessarily white and European to immigrate to the United States. And then when that was established, you have people that are cooking very regional food from places that are almost impossibly exotic that didn't exist here before. I mean, why wouldn't somebody be thrilled at the idea of a Uyghur restaurant opening and the idea of being able to see your mental culinary map of the world suddenly like meet in the middle as the Chinese food cooking like Afghans meets the Afghans cooking like Chinese. And you realize that the world really is round and it really does meet in the middle. That's tremendously exciting. I love Italian food. I mean, when I go on vacation and I have the chance to spend a month someplace, it's almost always to Italy, to Umbria and southern Tuscany specifically. And I love that food and I adore that food, and that food just isn't available here like that. I wish that it were. And believe me, I would write about it if it was.
Once again, that was Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly, who joins us here every week. Next, Eddie Lynn gets our goat. I'll explain after this.
Hi, everybody. This is Eddie Lynn from KCRW's Good Food. And we're at West Hollywood's branch of Tender Greens. And I'm here not for the fresh salads or for anything else on their typical menu. I'm actually here for a very special preparation of one of my favorite animals to eat, and that's goat. And I'm standing here with Chef Eric Hume of Tender Greens, West Hollywood, and he's going to explain what's going on with this goat and his preparation of it.
We'll be roasting whole animals once a month, and we'll also be bringing in a local brewer to pour beer for that. So in preparation of that, I procured some goats. We're going to split the goats open flat, so when we roast them flat, we're going to make a marinade with fresh herbs, garlic, some citrus. We're going to rub the outside of it, and we're also going to inject the goat into the meatier parts to really let the liquid get in there. And you want to do that because goats are really lean meat. It's actually the leanest meat there is. It's leaner than chicken and pork. So it's very lean, so that not having a lot of fat, it's kind of a, it can be a tough meat if you don't really get some flavor in there and get some juices in there. So we're going to split one of the goats so it lies flat. We're going to rub it, we're going to inject it, and we're going to get ready so it sits for a good about 24, 36 hours before we go ahead and fire that baby up. Okay, and for the marinade, I'm just keeping it pretty simple and straightforward. We want to accent the goat, not overpower the goat. So I'm going to make a simple marinade, shallots, garlic, rosemary, oregano, thyme, Meyer lemon juice, Meyer lemon zest, a little smoked paprika, salt, pepper, and olive oil. We'll put it in a blender, make it smooth so I can inject it into the animal so I don't get any chunks. We'll rub it. And this will sit for a while. It'll really get into the meat, get some nice flavor in there, but it won't overpower. We still will be able to taste the goat in this manner. If you don't marinate the goat or if you don't cook it in a good way, it's just going to turn really, really dry on you. So the fact that it's lean is great, but you also got to provide some moisture so you have a good tasting piece of meat when you're done.
All right, here comes the goat. So what's the first step to prepping this goat?
Okay, so the first thing with this, the goat is head's gone and it's been eviscerated. So for the style of roasting I'm going to do, I need to make this goat lie flat. So what I'm going to have to do is break down some of the backbone in the ribs and spread them apart so I can get a flat goat. All right. So now we got the rib cage spread out, laying nice and flat. So now I have to take them apart at the hips so I get the legs to lie flat also. Now inside, there's a lot of fat kind of in the back end up by the upper back area. I'm actually going to leave this in because the goat's so lean that when we cook it, the fat will melt, get into the meat, and help keep it moist. This is about the only fat, really, that is on this goat. Most goats are so lean.
Oh, man, I almost can't wait 2 days. I'm looking forward to this. I'm very excited about this. And thank you so much for allowing me into your kitchen to watch you prepare this beautiful goat.
All right. Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. Can't wait till Sunday.
All right, it's Sunday afternoon now, so a couple of days have elapsed, and the goat has been marinating for a while, and I'm hanging out again with Chef Eric Hume, standing in front of this big box with the goat inside, and there's a bunch of charcoal lying on top of it, heating up the contents inside. I've never seen this kind of setup. Can you explain how you're roasting these goats?
Yeah, basically it's a roasting box, La Caja China roasting box. Basically, the heat is on top. Everything else is enclosed. The heat's on top. Heat radiates then downward, heats up the box. It's a metal line, keeps in the heat, so it's slow, kind of wet roasts the animal you're roasting, goat or pig, what have you. So what it does is allows for a nice slow cook time, allows for the moisture to stay in, so you're going to get a much more moist animal once it's all done being cooked. I think it was developed in Cuba as a way to be cooking whole pig, but it has applications for any other whole animal. It takes a lot of the guesswork out of it, really gets it down a little bit more of a science in terms of weight per animal to how long you're going to cook it for. Today it's a little windy out here. It's causing a little bit of a havoc with the charcoal and just keeping it steady. So I had to keep a little more eye on it than I probably normally would if it wasn't so windy. About an hour or so, hour and a half, we'll flip it. Give another half hour so the skin can crisp up a little bit.
Excellent. I cannot wait to have a taste of this goat. All right, the goat is being uncovered. You can feel the anticipation in the air. It's so palpable. Okay, here we go. There it is. Gorgeous. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I got my goat. This is Eddie Lin at the Tender Greens in Hollywood for Good Food.
Listen to Good Food on demand on KCRW's app for the iPhone and Android, or subscribe to the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find info and recipes from today's guests there, too. Harriet Ells produced and edited today's show with Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laryl Garcia. Thanks to Bob Carlson, Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Messiha, and Becky Nelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.